This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about home foreclosures, both before and after the death of someone whose home is foreclosed upon. My guests are Pamela Simmons, a foreclosure attorney with offices in Soquel, which is in Santa Cruz County, California, and James Lamping, a trust and estates attorney with the Corte Madera law firm of Lippenberger Thompson. Mr. Lamping is a member of the executive committee of the Trust and Estate section of the State Bar of California. And funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Trust and Estate section of the State Bar. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Family Law section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Pamela, you're in Soquel. Can you hear us okay?
I can.
Thank you very much for joining us. And Jim is here in the studio with me. What we're going to do is have Jim talk a little bit about the things that one might want to think about if perhaps someone is quite ill, close to death and is dealing with a foreclosure. We're going to talk about that, and then we'll go to dealing with what some of the major issues are for someone who is in good health but is facing a foreclosure. So, Jim, what should we know about in terms of, post-death or preparing for this kind of a situation where there's a foreclosure?
Well, historically, in the past, what would happen is people would go through a foreclosure, and much to their surprise, April 15th of the next year, when they went to file their income taxes, they would have a big income tax bill. And
because of the forgiveness of debt.
Right. It's treated as though you sold your house for the amount of the debt that you have against it. And in some ways, that sort of makes sense, because if you bought your house for $200,000, it went up in value to $400,000, and you took out an equity loan for $200,000 and put it in the bank, in some ways you have profited. And so the law provided that in that instance you would be stuck with a big tax bill. But as things progressed, Congress decided that as more and more people were losing their home in foreclosure, that it really wasn't fair to stick them with a tax bill on top of it. It was really piling on top of it. And there were some exceptions, but oftentimes they just weren't broad enough, and so people had this additional problem on top of it. So the Congress responded by enacting the Mortgage Debt Relief Act of 2007, which for most people, for their principal residence, provided an exception so that they wouldn't be stuck with that big tax bill when they went through a foreclosure. The problem is that when Congress enacted that law, they weren't really thinking about what would happen if someone died and their house was foreclosed upon. And so the exceptions that Congress created may not and probably do not apply in the post-death context. And to make matters worse, for income tax purposes, your basis is stepped down on the date of death. So let me explain what that means. Your basis for someone when they buy a property, their basis is what they paid for it. So if you bought your house for $500,000, that's your basis. Now, when someone inherits property, their basis is its fair market value as of the date of death. And so if it goes up in value to $1 million, that $500,000 gain is forgiven. But the downside of that is if it goes down in value to $200,000, that's the basis for the people that have inherited it. And the reason that that's bad is that that is one of the things that's taken into account for calculating the taxable gain when the debt is forgiven. And so
the gain here in your example that you mm-hmm. gave would be $300,000.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. If it's a $500,000 debt against the property, if it was foreclosed upon the day before the person died and they have that $500,000 basis, there's no taxable gain because it's mm-hmm. $500,000 basis, $500,000 debt forgiven. If it's foreclosed upon the day after the person dies and it's stepped down in value to $200,000, now all of a sudden you've got a tax problem.
And that's what the person or persons who inherit the home
right.
are going to be facing.
Right.
So what are the consequences there?
Well, they could potentially be facing a tax debt that could wipe out other assets. The IRS could, and again, I should emphasize that the exceptions, they may or may not apply in the post-death context.
We're not sure what the IRS will do.
Right. And there are some convoluted aspects of the tax law that I won't get into the minutiae of, but... The point is that folks, if someone is very sick and they're terminally ill, this is something they should consider. Do they want that foreclosure to occur before they pass away or after? And it's something that they may want to consult with their CPA or their attorney on to figure that out, particularly if they have other assets that could be subject to collection by the IRS.
But if you are someone who is terminally ill and you're also facing a foreclosure, what control does the terminally ill person have to have that foreclosure occur while the person is still alive?
Sometimes there's nothing that you can do. Sometimes mm-hmm. that is true. In other cases, you might be able to approach the lender and
agree with the lender to have an earlier foreclosure.
Right. You could do a deed in lieu of foreclosure or attempt to have a short sale or negotiate something else.
Okay. So, I think you need, however, for those of us who are not up to your speed, yours
okay.
and Pamela's speed,
enough.
What's a short sale? What does that mean?
A short sale is where the lender accepts less than what is owed for the property to be sold. So in other words, in my earlier example, you have a $500,000 debt and the property is only worth $200,000. Well, the lender understands that you're not going to be able to get $500,000 for that property. The fair market value is now only $200,000. And the lender doesn't want to be stuck with an empty house because they have enough of those as it is. And so the lender says, okay, I'll accept $200,000 and just forgive that debt.
And forgive the rest of the $300,000.
Right.
So that's what a short sale is.
Right.
However, if in this situation... where the foreclosure takes place after the death of the decedent, after mm-hmm. the death of the homeowner.
Right.
And whoever has inherited the home may well have, with his $300,000, may well have some tax consequences depending on how the IRS wants to go.
Right, yes.
And if there's a $300,000 gain, or whatever, would it be considered a capital gain or a short-term or income to the person who inherited the home?
It depends on the type of loan that was against the property. I don't want to get too complicated. Yeah,
right.
I don't want to get into too much of the details of the Internal Revenue Code. Your listeners will find a cure for their insomnia.
We don't want them turning us off.
Right.
No turn off. So okay, let's do this. For those of you who've joined us in the last few minutes, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about home foreclosures. We've just been talking with James Lamping about some of the consequences if someone is terminally ill and is also dealing with a potential foreclosure of his or her home. Some of the things that should be considered. Pamela Simmons is also my guest, and she's a foreclosure attorney down in Soquel, which is in Santa Cruz County. And now we're going to talk a bit about what are some of the things that you, if you are confronted with a foreclosure yourself, some of the things that you should be thinking about. Start us off on this, will you, Pamela?
Sure. I think one of the things, though, going back for just a second to what Jim was talking about, might help the audience to understand is that as between a short sale, a deed in lieu of foreclosure, and a foreclosure, the potential tax problem is the same. So the fact that in Jim's scenario, the foreclosure happened on the property that was owed $500,000, but it was only worth $200,000, if that same transaction occurred in a short sale where someone bought it for $200,000, the canceled debt is the same amount.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change the equation. And a deed in lieu of foreclosure, because that might, in someone who's terminally ill, if they were able to do a deed in lieu, that might actually help so that the taxable event did occur while the person was still alive. And so I'd like to just explain real quick what a deed in lieu is.
Please, if you would.
It's kind of like when you buy a car and then you can't make the car payments anymore. You turn the car back over to the lender with the pink slip. You are essentially giving back the property with a deed.
To the lender.
To the lender,
okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got the property, someone deeded it to you. You now deed it back to the lender. But it's a special deed. It's called a deed in lieu of foreclosure. So it is essentially saying, rather than you foreclose on me, I'd like to just give the property back. And actually, traditionally, lenders would pay money to a homeowner who was willing to deed the property back.
Mm.
Because of the fact that it means that the lender doesn't have to go through the costs of conducting the whole foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And they also save time because a deed in lieu is effective immediately. Now, you can't just send a deed in. The lenders actually have to accept it. They have to willingly say, yes, I will take the property from you. And when there's more than one loan on the property, which a lot of the houses these days have more than one loan. They have a first loan and a second loan and maybe even a third loan. You generally can't do a deed in lieu of foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll really only work if you just have the one loan, the first mortgage on the property.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something to consider.
Okay. What about, one of the things that has had so much notoriety are loan modifications, and of course there have been, the state bar has conducted itself in such a way to discipline or is in the process of disciplining a lot of attorneys who were doing loan modifications and actually were allegedly scamming consumers. Could you talk a little bit about that, both the loan modification and also the attorney situation, the attorney disciplining situation?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, what happened was, when the meltdown occurred, a lot of attorneys were out of work because the real estate market, as you know, just kind of dropped out the bottom. And there were a lot of attorneys looking for work. And at the same time, the lenders were starting to work with borrowers and offer them loan modifications. And homeowners were looking for people to help them through, what is essentially the rigors of trying to get a loan modification. So they were looking for someone to be a go-between, a conduit between the lender and themselves. A number of attorneys stepped into this vacuum. However, and I believe that the majority of the attorneys that did this were actually well-meaning attorneys who were trying to help and keep their business practice up, right? But the problem is that loan modifications are not really legal work. They're more like Scribner work. What you do is you get a list of the financial documents that the lender wants, and you gather them up, and then you send them to the lender. And then you wait, and you wait, and you wait, maybe calling them every once in a while. You still got everything. You're still working on it. And then eventually the lender might, and I say might, offer a loan modification. At that point, there might be some legal work to be able to help the borrower read what the terms of the loan modification is, but that's it. There is no negotiation with the lenders.
Mm-hmm.
The lenders, with their own internal processes, decide if they're going to offer a loan mod and what those terms are. And then what happened on top of that is that the number of loan modifications that were actually being offered by the lender were very small. So you have hundreds of thousands of people who were paying money to not only attorneys but real estate agents and then also companies that were completely unassociated with any licensing saying, I will help you get a loan mod, and they weren't getting their loan mods.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So the legislature stepped in, and they enacted what was known as Senate Bill 94. That has been codified now to Civil Code Section 2944.7. And what it effectively said is that you, as an attorney, cannot accept payment to help a homeowner get a loan modification or help them with forbearance work until you've actually accomplished the task that you said you were going to do to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So if you said, look, let me help you get this loan mod, once you got them the loan mod, then you could charge them. But before that, you can't charge any money. And the state bar has come down and said, in fact, that includes taking payment from the homeowner and putting it into the trust account. We're all used to holding money in trust
mm-hmm.
for our clients. But in this specific case, even that is forbidden by law.
Now, this Civil Code Section 2944.7, did it apply only to attorneys, or did it apply to anyone who might be trying to get a consumer to pay a fee in advance of work performed?
Oh, you know what? I don't know the answer to that.
I think it applies across the board.
Okay.
I don't think it was just attorneys, but what was it that the state bar was so concerned about? Because there's a lot of publicity about the state bar bringing disciplinary actions against attorneys.
There were certainly a few attorneys out there who were not acting in a way that we as attorneys are required to do. You know, they were basically voiding a number of the fiduciary rules that we are supposed to follow, the rules where we're supposed to put our clients' needs above our own needs, and those type of things. And they were, in fact, maybe not even being found to not even take the steps to try to get someone a loan mod. There were
some misrepresentations
right,
made.
Fraud.
Yeah.
Actual
fraud.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this: What warnings do you have for people to try to protect themselves in where they're facing a foreclosure? Are there some things that you would suggest to them at this point?
Oh, certainly. And I got to tell you that. Going back for just a second to the mod arena,
yes, sure.
The loan modification arena, it's actually really quite a problem now, because what's happening now is that there are lots of people, and I mean hundreds of thousands of people around the country, who are in what are called trial loan mod programs, where they, in fact, do not yet have an approved loan modification offer from the lender,
mm-hmm.
but the lender has said, we do as part of the HAMP program is for the borrower needs to prove their ability to pay the lesser amount. And so they put them on these trial loan mods, and they're supposed to make three payments in the lower loan mod amount and for 3 months. And if they can make those payments on time, then that shows their ability to do it. And then they should be able to get their loan modification. Well, these trial loan mods have gone on and on and on. I mean, it is not unheard of for someone to call my office and say they've been in a trial loan mod period for a year.
You mean paying monthly payment, the lower monthly payment over a year period?
Right. And these are the payments that are approved by the lender. In fact, the amount mm-hmm. that the payment is, the lender has developed and come up with, right?
Yeah.
And they believe that they are essentially making the payments as required by the lender and therefore should not be in any kind of trouble. But the truth is that these payments are not being applied to their mortgage payment. They're being kept kind of in a side account, a suspense account, while they decide if they're going to allow the loan modification to occur. And what's happening to a lot of people is that they get a notice of default, which is your first notice. It's a recorded document that comes to you via certified mail and regular mail. And it says you are in default, and it is telling you that foreclosure has started. And when they get these notices, they call the lender, and the lender says, don't worry about it. You're in this loan modification program, and we will not be foreclosing on your house. But, in fact, they do foreclose on the house.
Well, that's a misrepresentation.
Well, yes, it is.
What can a consumer do about that, if anything?
It's very tough, because the courts are not being very sympathetic to someone coming in and saying, they told me on the phone that they wouldn't foreclose,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So that would be the first tip, I would say, is get these things in writing, right? If you come in to court with something in writing that the lender gave you that says we will not foreclose, the courts are much more willing to listen to you complain about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even undo a foreclosure. Though, you know, in my opinion, you just never want to get that close. What I'd like to say is that there's another notice that gets issued. It's called a notice of trustee sale.
Mm-hmm.
This is a document that comes after 3 months after the notice of default. And in this document, it actually lists the foreclosure sale date. And if you get that notice, you really need to do something, because in as little as 21 days, they could foreclose on your house.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. if they foreclose on your house, it is really, really hard to get that undone. It can be done. I've done it myself. But it's really tough. And now you're talking about having to hire a lawyer, spend thousands of dollars. And the better thing to do is take steps and get either it postponed, which you can get that in writing as well, or you can go and consult with the bankruptcy attorney, because in certain cases, bankruptcy will stop a foreclosure, and you can sometimes finish your loan modification program within that bankruptcy now. That was just changed June 1st. There was a problem with the loan mods that the lenders were basically holding it against the homeowners if they went into bankruptcy.
Yes.
But a change in the HAMP rules effective June 1st said that they could no longer do that.
So the HAMP, how do you spell that?
H-A-M as in Mary, P as in Paul.
What does that stand for?
Well, Homeowners Assistance Modification Program.
I see. So, and this became effective June 1st of this year?
It's a governmental program where lenders can opt in.
Yes.
And if the house falls within certain parameters, they're supposed to follow a certain structure to determine whether or not the homeowner should or should not get their loan modification.
So by considering going into bankruptcy, there is some potential or some possibility that a homeowner could save his or her or their home.
Yes, absolutely.
Because a bankruptcy is something that does take some time. At least it would be a matter of probably, I suppose, at least 6 months, would it not?
Well, there's for most consumers, there's two types of bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm not a bankruptcy attorney, mm-hmm. so probably the bankruptcy attorneys out here will cringe while I try to explain this. But there is Chapter 7 and there's Chapter 13. Chapter 7 is relatively quick. I think it's about 4 months.
I see.
Chapter 13 can go as long as 3 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you take your arrearage and you pay it over time. But they are doing loan modification. The HAMP loan modifications are now being done within the Chapter 13 context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it is something that I believe people should consider.
Yes.
When they're staring down the barrels of a foreclosure. Because I just on Tuesday received a call from a woman who had called and checked with her bank on Friday that they were postponing the foreclosure, and she was told yes. And on Tuesday, she found out her house was sold in foreclosure on Monday.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, and this is not this. You know, it's very disturbing. But we're getting lots of calls like this.
That's really outrageous.
Very common.
Yeah.
And it's my concern about. Well, I support the enactment of 29447. I am really concerned that now consumers really need attorneys to help them sort through these legal issues that are related to loan modification. And yet I'm worried that some attorneys may be afraid to help. So
why, because of the state bar's concern over this?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we need education on this, obviously, and I hope that attorneys will educate themselves and see, you know, the merits of trying to help consumers. We've got about maybe two more minutes left of the statewide version of the program. For those of you who listen to the program live, we will continue live in the Bay Area. We continue live on the Internet at www.kalw.org. And in the second half hour of the program, we will be taking your calls if you have some questions. Pamela, do you have in the next minute or minute and a half, any other sage messages for us?
What pressure.
Yeah. I want the sage message. And now.
Oh, boy. No.
Okay.
There's really an awful lot for people to know. You know what the sage message is?
Yeah.
Get educated. Go.
Yes.
Talk to an attorney and find out everything you need to know when you're in this situation. There is an awful lot.
What kind of an attorney would you talk to?
Someone who understands secured real estate transactions,
mm-hmm.
the deficiency laws, the foreclosure laws, and also the tax laws.
Boy, that's a lot to know. Would you say a real estate attorney would know much of that or not?
You know, it just so much depends.
Okay. All right. What you want to do if you're confronted with this and you don't have an attorney in mind is probably call your local bar association lawyer referral service and tell them what you're confronted with. Hopefully they could refer you to them.
Yes, I think that's a great idea.
Okay. We are now going to break at this point. We'll be back in live in just a minute or so. It is just about 27 minutes after 7 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about home foreclosures. We've been talking about, in the last few minutes, foreclosures well before someone's death. We started the program talking about what the consequences are if someone is terminally ill and also has a foreclosure going on. What might that person do in terms of trying to protect, let's say, the heirs of the home should the person die and then the foreclosure occurs afterward? And, of course, the heirs, unfortunately, may have some potential tax consequences under those circumstances. So I want to give you our phone number here in case you are going through a foreclosure. You are, let's say someone close to you is going through a foreclosure. The number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. I also would like to let you know that this Saturday, which is June 12th, in Menlo Park at the Burgess Recreation Center, there is going to be a foreclosure fair, and it's sponsored by San Mateo County Supervisor Rose Jacobs Gibson, and it's free. It's Saturday, June 12th, from 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Burgess Recreation Center, 701 Laurel Street in Menlo Park. That's 701 Laurel Street in Menlo Park. You'll be able to speak with a HUD-approved housing counselor to discuss what your options may be in order to avoid foreclosure. You'll be able to speak on a one-on-one basis with a lender or lenders about how to better manage your monthly mortgage payments. You'll get more information about President Obama's Making Home Affordable program and the City of Menlo Park's Foreclosure Prevention Program. One of the things I want to invite you to do here, even though this is being done in Menlo Park and part of San Mateo County, anyone who's listening to this program who can get to Menlo Park and who is facing a foreclosure, I think you would find this is valuable. I'll be there. Not that I am by any means a foreclosure expert. I am not, but someone in my office, one of the inspectors, Bill Massey, will be there and will be doing a presentation to people. There are going to be a lot of really, I think, important people to you if you're facing a foreclosure. And if you're going to do this, please bring copies of all of your necessary mortgage and financial documents to the Foreclosure Resource Fair. And again, that's this Saturday, June 12th. 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Burgess Recreation Center in Menlo Park, 701 Laurel Street. I'll give you a phone number so you can get more information. 650-328-1890. 650-328-1890. And my guests are James Lamping, a trust and estates attorney with the Corte Madera law firm of Lippenberger Thompson. Jim is a member of the Executive Committee of the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, which is one of the funders of Your Legal Rights. My other guest is Pamela Simmons, a foreclosure attorney with offices in SoCal, Santa Cruz County. And so what we're going to do is very quickly, if we can, get to our calls. And for those of you who have a legal question, whether it's in foreclosures or not, what I want to suggest to you, if you do have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KLW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar also has a lawyer referral service, and you can call your own during normal business hours. That number is 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county, every county in California has a Bar Association and lawyer referral service. Call it during normal business hours. You should be able to get a human being to speak with, tell them what the problem is, and they'll do their best to find someone experienced in the area you're having difficulty in, and they'll set up a half an hour consultation for you with the attorney. And you'll pay, depending on the county, maybe a low of $25, maybe a high of $35 for the half an hour. It's a great consumer service. All right, let's start with Julie. Julie, welcome to your legal rights.
Thank you. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you talked about this. But in the past, I know that if you decided to walk away from the property prior to foreclosure, that you would have to pay some tax for the loan forgiveness. And I know there's been some changes in that, but I don't know what they are and if they apply to all properties or what is the status of that.
Let's take that. Pamela, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
We did talk about this a little bit. Jim talked about it at great length, but the situation is that it when debt is forgiven, and it doesn't necessarily have to be with your house, but in the context of foreclosures, when you end up not having to pay back some amount of debt, the lender sends out to the IRS a 1099. It can be a 1099A. Or a 1099-C, and it notifies the IRS that you've had a cancellation of debt,
mm-hmm.
and this debt can be deemed as income to you so that you might have to pay tax on that money as if you got it in your pocket.
What do you mean, might?
Well, because there's a number of ways to avoid the tax. The standard, the old-fashioned way of avoiding it is that if the debt is non-recourse to you, meaning you were not personally liable to it, to the debt to begin with,
uh-huh.
then the cancellation of that debt doesn't create income because you weren't personally liable to begin with.
Okay.
And where that applies in homes primarily is that in the state of California,
for the deficiency,
when you purchase a home, if it's going to be your residence,
right.
That is a non-recourse debt as a matter of law.
Okay.
So that's one way.
Well, what about if it's a second loan or an equity loan?
Well, it can be a second loan.
Uh-huh.
Many, many people used first and second loans to buy their homes.
Uh-huh.
That was kind of standard in 04, 05, 06 to do an 80-20 loan, and it was a first and a second. And the second is still still non-recourse.
If it was part of the purchase.
Correct.
Okay.
But if you refinance, or if you later got a home equity line or that kind of thing, that
right.
would not be non. That would be recourse loan. It would not. It's not non-recourse.
So a refi, you still have the income for the debt forgiveness.
It's possible. Now Bush, before he left office, enacted the
Mortgage Debt Relief Act of 2007.
Yeah, Qualified Principal Residence and Debtedness Act.
Uh-huh.
And that said that if you used the debt to either purchase or fix up or build the property,
uh-huh.
even if it wasn't purchase money, it would still be a non-taxable event.
Okay, and what is that called? Qualified what?
It's called Qualified Principal Residence Indebtedness Act.
Okay.
And that still exists, does it not?
It does. Now,
okay.
There was some hoo-ha because the state of California was going to not participate in that particular act so that you were going to have the situation where your debt might be not taxable federally, but it could be still taxable state. Uh-huh. But at the last minute this year, the state of California opted in.
Do you know what the bill number is for that, how somebody would find that?
It wasn't really a bill, I don't think. It was, you know, what I recall is that the governor just decided to go ahead and opt in. And so this year it's fine, but the question is, what about next year?
Mm-hmm.
The other ways to avoid the taxes we discussed earlier is insolvency or bankruptcy, as long as the bankruptcy is filed before the taxable event. And the taxable
before the
event
sale, before the trustee, before the trustee's sale?
Yes.
Yeah. Is
okay.
It true that you stand a better chance of getting the modification if you file a bankruptcy?
I don't know that it's true that you stand a better chance. They have just recently changed the rules so that you can get a modification within the bankruptcy, but basically it's very hard to get a loan modification, period.
I know that. I was just wondering if a bankruptcy judge were involved in it, if that would motivate the lenders to behave. I don't know.
We could always hope.
Okay. All right. Thank you, guys. Yeah. It's a terrific
Julie, thank
program.
You. Good questions. Thank you very much for
okay.
calling.
Bye-bye.
All right. This is Your Legal Rights. Join us with your question, your comment, your concern. If you are facing a foreclosure or someone is close to you is facing a foreclosure, a relative or a neighbor or a friend, the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. I'm pleased that we don't have a flood of calls, which means that the audience listening to the program apparently are okay. I hope so. Unless their electricity has been cut off, then they wouldn't even necessarily be listening to the show unless they were in their car. But in any event, I'm not trying to make light, certainly, of foreclosures, but I am encouraging you, if you are confronted with a foreclosure or know someone who is confronted with a foreclosure, if you will join us with your call, your question, your comment, your concern. Again, before we take our next call, I just want to let you know that for those of you who, wherever you are in the Bay Area, if you're willing to travel down to Menlo Park, there is a foreclosure fair that will be this Saturday, June 12th, at the Burgess, B-U-R-G-E-S-S, Recreation Center in Menlo Park at 701 Laurel, L-A-U-R-E-L Street. And if you, and that's between 8:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. And if you'd like more information, the number is 650-328-1890. 650-328-1890. A lot of effort has gone into putting this together by San Mateo County Supervisor Rose Jacobs Gibson. Also, it's the city of Menlo Park is one of the sponsors. Certainly the county is, naturally. And then also the Northern California Urban Development Organization, which is a nonprofit organization located in East Palo Alto. And you'll learn what your legal rights are. And if you want to go, what you need to do is bring copies of all of your necessary mortgage and financial documents to the Foreclosure Resource Fair. And my guests on this segment of Your Legal Rights are Pamela Simmons, a foreclosure attorney, and James Lamping, a trust and estates attorney. And Barbara, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. I was wondering, my daughter and I went through a short sale in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much damage that does to your credit rating and how long it takes to recover.
Well, that's an interesting question. Do you have any thoughts on that one, Pamela?
Yeah. It's pretty devastating to your credit going through a short sale. And especially when you consider most people who've gone through a short sale had, you know, a 30-day late and then a 60-day late and then a 90-day late. And do you have any ideas how many months she wasn't making a mortgage payment?
It was 3 months.
That's all?
Yeah, before the negotiating began, because the bank required that the realtor show the house at one price closer to the original price.
Mm-hmm.
And when there were no bites, no one came to buy it, he was permitted to begin to lower it until he finally got it to a price that someone was willing to pay.
Mm-hmm. And
that's not the program any longer. Short sales are done on a much more expedited basis.
now, because as you can tell with the way Barbara was explaining it, it took months and months just to find the right price. They no longer get involved in telling you what price to list your property at. So, but to answer your question, it's a severe negative hit. I understand that Fannie Mae has just issued guidelines that say on a short sale, you can apply to get a new, buy a new house. Now, I think it's a 2-year waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
So that's much better than it was. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'll tell you is that, of course, we have really gone through some major, major changes in the way credit has been issued. I mean, we were at one point where as long as your FICO score was good, your dog could even buy a house, right? And then we went through a period where it didn't matter how good your credit was, you could not get a home loan, period. And now it's just very, very hard to get a home loan. It's really hard to say what's going to happen because there's so many people going through this that it may or may not have a really significant hit. But I will say it certainly is a significant hit right now.
Anything else, Barbara?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for calling. Mm-hmm. All right, we've got Fred. Fred, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, my question is regarding if you own multiple properties and for financial reasons, you want to let one of them go through a foreclosure, can the bank come after the other properties that you own?
Those are the deficiency rules, Fred, and it completely depends on what the situation is. In the state of California, there are two different kinds of foreclosures. One is a judicial foreclosure, and the other is a non-judicial foreclosure. And traditionally, most foreclosures are done non-judicially. For the bank, it's a very short process, about 4 months, and it doesn't cost them very much money, where a judicial foreclosure takes a considerably more longer period of time and is very expensive for the lender to do. If the lender opts to foreclose non-judicially, they waive any right to a deficiency against you. So they can't come after you for any shortfall if they foreclose non-judicially. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't have someone coming after you, because if you have more than one loan on the property, you can end up in a situation where it's called a sold-out junior, where let's say the first forecloses non-judicially and the second gets cut out, they could come after you. So you really do need to meet with an attorney who's familiar with these rules, because for each person, the situation can be different. You have to know the facts of their particular case.
Fred, where are you located?
San Francisco.
Yeah. Did you get the phone number for the lawyer referral service?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
all right. So my suggestion is certainly spend whatever San Francisco's rate is, $25 up to $35 for half an hour consultation with, an attorney who can tell you what some of the issues are, at least to get you going on this. Thanks very much for calling.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Also, I want to let you know that, by the way, tomorrow, June 10th, at the San Mateo County Law Library, there will be a noontime lecture on law for landlords. And this is also something I think that those of you who are tenants who are able to go, you might learn something about your rights and the rights of landlords and the obligations of both tenants and landlords. It'll be presented by Richard Kelly, who actually spends, I think, most of his time doing landlord-tenant law. He's an attorney in Redwood City. So that's tomorrow. Everyone is invited to go to the San Mateo County Law Library tomorrow, Thursday, June 10th at noon. You can bring your bag lunch if you wish. You'll learn about the rights and responsibilities of being a landlord, and I'm sure Mr. Kelly will talk about the rights and obligations of tenants. And that's at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City, right across the street from the Hall of Justice in San Mateo County, or actually in Redwood City. And if you'd like more information about that, the number is 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. And let's see, we've got Karen. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, good evening, Chuck and guests. Yes, I have a question about foreclosures.
Sure.
Since the reason for the epidemic of hundreds of thousands of people being foreclosed on was because the banks and the securities industry sliced up the mortgage and made them into mortgage-backed securities that they sold all over the world, like to Germany and Iceland and, you know, Italy and Japan and everything. So if someone was going to be foreclosed on by a bank, and if they were to demand the original paper that, of the property ownership, if that original deed of trust or whatever it's called has already been sliced up and created mortgage-backed securities, so that means it's in 100 pieces, and the bank can't produce the original paper because it's been divided, then does the person being foreclosed on have a right to stay where they are unless their demand is being met? Because everybody that's been calling up is terrified of people coming after them and the IRS coming after them. And what it should be is that we should be going after them. And the people that are being foreclosed on should be going after the banks and the Congress people to pass these draconian laws, because every time the little person in the House gets some kind of edge or has an ability to sidestep all this aggressive action taken against them, then the Congress goes and passes some other kind of law. So you can't do this, and you can't file for bankruptcy, and now you're going to be charged as this is income tax.
Let me get some comments for you, Karen. How do you know so much about this, by the way?
Oh, I've listened to a number of people that have been in, let's say, Wall Street, and that have been broadcasting on the radio talking about exactly what caused this epidemic.
Let me get some comments for you in terms of the original paper on this. Thanks very much for calling. Take the answer on the air, would you?
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
Jeff.
Thanks, Karen. Pamela, would you like to talk about this? What about this? If the bank cannot, or whoever's doing the foreclosure, cannot produce the original deed of trust, is that some kind of a potential defense for the homeowner who's facing a foreclosure?
It's not. The deed of trust is recorded at the county recorder's office,
right,
in the county where the property is located.
Yes.
And that is the document. So that the deed of trust, I believe what she's talking about, and I don't really want to get into it too much because it's extremely complex, but I think what she's really talking about is the idea of the note.
The note. What I owe so much to the bank.
Exactly.
Yes.
As you know, as the deed of trust secures the debt owed under the note.
I think I then misspoke. Okay, so let's say we can't find the original note. What happens then?
In judicial foreclosure states such as Florida, Ohio, and New York, in order for them to foreclose, they have to actually go into court and sue the homeowner to foreclose. And it gives the homeowner the right to come back in and say, wait a second, Your Honor, I don't think this person actually owns my note, and I owe my note to so-and-so. And so then you have an issue with standing. You know, it's simple standing issue. Does the lender who comes in have the right to foreclose? In California, we don't have that situation because we have a third-party trustee who's empowered to bring the foreclosure,
mm-hmm,
and they don't. You can't go in to them and say, I don't think you have the right.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to actually hire a lawyer to go into court to quiet title or stop the foreclosure in some way. And so it's much, much harder to use that where's the note,
mm-hmm,
defense. Now, in bankruptcy, it works. And if they aren't able to show that they have the legal right to pursue, to make a claim, right? When you go into bankruptcy, the lender has to file papers to say, I'm owed this debt. And you can object to that claim by saying, no, I don't owe you that money.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does have some viability there.
So bankruptcy is something that people should really certainly explore carefully with going to a bankruptcy attorney about this. By the way, if you are confronted with that, let me give you the I certainly would like you to consider getting a bankruptcy attorney who's a certified specialist and through the Board of Legal Specialization, and that number, the statewide number, is 415-538-2100, 415-538-2100, or you can go to the website for the Board of Legal Specialization, and that's www.californiaspecialist.org. Specialist is singular, by the way, www.californiaspecialist.org, and either using the phone number or the website address, you can find out who the certified specialists are if you're looking for a bankruptcy attorney in your geographic area. All right, let's do this. Ron, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, I have a kind of a two-part question. I'm a board member for a local homeowners association, and I'm wondering, as a member of the board, what obligation do I have to protect the interest of the homeowners association to stay on top of whether or not one of our owners is going into foreclosure? And part B of that two-part question is, once somebody goes into foreclosure, what recourse do we have as a board to recover the homeowners association dues from the either the homeowner who went into foreclosure or the new homeowner?
Do you have some thoughts on that, Pamela?
You know, this is an area of law that I only know a little bit about. But I would say that the Homeowners Association has a duty to try to collect the Homeowners Association dues, because that's how you have the money to do the things you're required to do. My understanding is, and what I tell consumers that come in to consult with me, is that they are personally liable for the homeowners' dues, but also the property is liable. As you know, you could start foreclosure proceedings and attempt a foreclosure yourself when someone fails to pay the dues. However, that's not helpful to you guys anymore, because you don't want to take the responsibility of paying the other debts on the property, I would imagine. So I think that, do you have a management company that you're working with?
Yes, we do have a management company, and but as a member of the board, I want to know some of these things myself. Also, I want to know, do I have a duty to monitor and find out if somebody is at risk of foreclosure?
Ron, what are you concerned about? What is the consequence that you are concerned about if you didn't pay any attention to the foreclosure at all?
Well, I want to make sure that we as board members and the board in general is not liable for any kind of negligence. We're not anticipating that somebody's in danger of foreclosure, not taking the proper steps to make sure that we protect the interest of the homeowners association.
So, I see. Okay. Well, very, very interesting thought. And this, of course, Pamela, I think you probably exhausted your knowledge about this, or have you?
I did. I think that they should meet with their management, the managers that they've hired, and my belief would be that the managers also have an attorney on retainer, and I think they should consult with them.
And probably, they should consult with the attorney who actually specializes in homeowners associations. Ron, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Sorry we didn't have, the complete answer for you. Mick, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
Actually calling on behalf of my brother. Can you speak to laws in Nevada, or are we strictly in California? I know you mentioned New York and Florida a few minutes ago.
Oh, I'm familiar a little bit with the laws in Nevada.
I'm sorry. So my brother is in a situation where he's completely, like a lot of people out there, upside down on his home in Nevada. He stopped paying his mortgage about, eight or so months ago. The idea that he potentially could either do a short sale, or he might walk, or he might declare bankruptcy. And his principal loan, I believe, through one of the major lenders, they just decided to go into collection on him. So I guess my question is, and I heard you talk about 1099 and income if you have debt, and I think he isn't even aware of that, and he needs to get more information on, is he going to be liable as far as the IRS is concerned? for the original amount of the loan and the difference if you were to do a short sale. But once you go into a collection scenario, whether it's the first or the second loan, he's being advised now to get an attorney to fight that amount, to sort of, you know, back that amount out that the collection agency now, of course, wants to get, you know, as much money as they can. I mean, is his short sale hopes essentially dead, or is he, if he were able to, and again, I don't know if it was the first or the second loan that's in collection, but essentially resolve whatever that loan is with the collection agency, negotiate the second loan, and still potentially effectuate a short sale, or is he just in trouble? And then also a second rule annex to that. I know you talked about bankruptcy earlier. There's Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, correct me if I'm wrong, and they're very different scenarios as to how that plays out with your credit. And
this is an enormous question, Mick. Has your brother gone to see an attorney in Nevada yet?
I don't believe he has.
He needs to. I'm sure. Let me do this, because you've asked so many questions, and it's very difficult to give you, I think, an answer that will be very valuable in the remaining very short time we have. My suggestion to you, if you don't mind, is communicate with your brother and tell him. I'm sure in Nevada they have bar associations, depending on what part of the state he's in, with lawyer referral services. He really needs to contact the bar association, lawyer referral service, and probably it would be wise for him, as Pamela has suggested at least a couple of times during the program, to have an appointment at least with a bankruptcy attorney to find out what may be available to him in this. And he may want to also, you know, seek the advice of an attorney who deals in foreclosures also, which wouldn't necessarily be a bankruptcy attorney, although I think some bankruptcy attorneys now are getting very much involved with foreclosures and helping consumers deal with that. So,
Jim, the thing with Nevada he needs to know is that Nevada doesn't have any of the consumer protections that California does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that your brother really absolutely needs to get some legal help.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Mick.
Thank you very much.
Communicate with your brother. You know, unfortunately, we have just about run out of time. And I'm sorry for those of you who are waiting to talk to my guests, but we have, unfortunately. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. A lot of very good information, and thank you for, you know, letting everybody at least have an insight of the problems involved. Pamela Simmons is a foreclosure attorney. Her offices are in Soquel, which is Santa Cruz County. Pamela, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I really appreciate you joining us on the program. And Jim Lamping, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim is a trust and estates attorney with the Corte Madera law firm of Lippenberger Thompson. He's a member of the executive committee of the trust and estate section of the state bar, which is one of the funders of this program. And I want to tell you that, by the way, next week we're going to be talking about employment issues affecting persons with criminal histories. And I'll have attorneys here with nonprofit organizations, the National Employment Law Project, and the East Bay Community Law Center. So if you know of someone who may have a criminal history and is having difficulty because of that with employment, please let that person know. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Trusts and Estates section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Labor and Employment Law section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. And then for those of you who can, there is this foreclosure fair tomorrow in Menlo Park at Burgess Recreation Center, 701 Laurel Street. I hope you can make it. Thanks very much for listening to the program. I'm Chuck Finney.